What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Beautiful dreamer, wake unto me. Starlight and dewdrops are waiting for thee. Sounds of the rude world heard in the day, lulled by the moonlight have all passed away. Beautiful dreamer, queen of my song, list while I woo thee with soft melody. Gone are the cares of life's busy throng. Beautiful dreamer, awake unto me. Beautiful dreamer, out on the sea. Mermaids are chanting the wild lorelei. Over the streamlet, vapors are born, waiting to fade at the bright coming morn. Beautiful dreamer, beam on my heart. E'en as the morn on the streamlet and sea, then will all clouds of sorrow depart. Beautiful dreamer, awake unto me. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane Patreon channel. We get to talk all about Beautiful Dreamer today, who is named after that song. Let me welcome my incredible guests, the lovely Erica Schultz and the lovely Patricio Oliver. I'm so happy to have you both here. You're delightful. Let me have you introduce yourselves, tell everybody your pronouns, a little about you, and I would love to hear your early thoughts on Beautiful Dreamer and the Morlocks, who are all amazing. Let me welcome Patricio first. Hi, Patricio. Welcome back to Grey Malkin Lane.
Hi, thanks for having me back again. I'm so pleased to be here again. Well, I'm Patricio Oliver, pronouns he, him. I'm from Buenos Aires, Argentina, in the south of the universe. And I'm a graphic designer, illustrator, comic book artist, and university teacher here in Buenos Aires University. I adore how mysterious she is, how little we know about her. I love how she dresses. She's amazing. She has this sort of decadent, like, glamour in her. I love that. And I love the Morlocks. I mean, for me, the Morlocks are like one of the most incredible creations from the X-Men and from the 80s. I adore what they mean, what the symbolism they have behind them. And I think that the early 80s Morlocks are the best ones. The ones that I really, really, really enjoy a lot. I'm like...
Yeah, there's some really incredible characters. We're going to get into some of the weird ones in this, but I love Morlocks as well. Another person who loves the Morlocks is Erica Schultz, because she's been writing about them. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you? Patricio, it's so nice to meet you. And by the way, speaking of lovely, you really do have a very lovely voice, Chad.
Thank you.
My name is Erica Schultz. I am a comic book writer. I'm currently writing Laura Kinney Wolverine for Marvel and Spawn Rhapsody for Todd McFarlane Productions and Image Comics. I did have Beautiful Dreamer in issue number 7 of Laura Kinney Wolverine. She was a lot of fun to work with.
She's an interesting character. Okay, so Beautiful Dreamer, the song that I just sang, was an old parlor song from like the 1860s. The writer is Stephen Foster. A lot of people say this was his last song, but they say that about several of his songs. He has an interesting thing. Parlor songs, right, you sing them around the piano in the bar. It's the kind of thing everybody can chip in with. You picture like a lady on a swing almost, is how I kind of view this song. This this song almost has kind of a haunting lilt to it. Stephen Foster would sometimes write about women who had passed. One of his most famous songs by it, for example, was Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. He had a sister that died. He's well studied, well regarded. He's written some songs you've definitely heard of. And this song has been recorded by many, many artists over the years. I think the first place I ever heard it was on Pushing Daisies, that like old like musical hour-long television show from like the early 2000s, where the lady that played Audrey in Little Shop of Horrors, the actress that played her, sang this song on an episode.
Ellen Green.
I'm like, that's lovely. And I remember looking this song up at the time. It's been recorded by Bing Crosby, maybe most famously, but there's a lot of people like Jerry Lee Lewis and Roy Orbison. And so this is a super famous song. Were you guys familiar? I think even Bobby Darin did a version of this, which is funny to me. Were you guys familiar with the song version of this?
I was vaguely, I knew that it was an old parlor song, and I knew that it had, and I knew, like, if I started to hear the melody, I'd be like, oh yeah, I know what that is. And it's not just, I mean, Bobby Darin, yeah, and Bing Crosby, but I mean, so many people recorded this. This is like a B-side, I think, for so many people. But yeah, I mean, I was familiar with it, and it took a second for the click to be, oh, that's why she's named Beautiful Dreamer,
Yeah.
you know?
It gives a little bit of like a haunting vibe. There's very if you guys know the story of Lorelai, one of my earliest Patreons with Demando was on Lorelai, which is about that like the siren lady on the sea that enchants sailors and they crash, right? And Lorelai is very that character. Beautiful Dreamer has very much it's that kind of feeling you get when you first wake up or are falling to sleep, and there's kind of an image off in the distance that's gonna lure you away. It kind of gives that energy a little bit. Patricia, were you familiar with the song?
I think I've heard it before in any in a, I don't know if a horror movie or something like that, like an old recording, but I'm not sure. It's like when I first read the lyrics, I say, I know this song. And when you start singing it, I say, I know this song, but I'm not sure where. I can't place in my mind where I remember it from, but I'm sure I've heard it on, I don't know, any a horror movie with an old like vinyl recording and something
That's
like
how I want to
that.
picture it. You want to
Yeah.
picture like a classic, like beautiful woman singing this, but it's like that echo sound, and there's like a creepy girl climbing up the stairs. It's like playing, and there's a rat.
Very.
Yeah, no, I really love the imagery of that. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, where did you both first meet the Morlocks as fans? These are characters, I believe I first met them in the X-Men cartoon, where there's the episode where the X-Men are like, oh, you guys are all homeless, so we're gonna come in the sewer tunnels and celebrate Christmas with you instead of inviting you back to our fancy mansion.
Probably the cartoon and then following up with the comic.
Actually, my first Uncanny X-Men issue has the Morlocks in it. It was an issue from the 80s when they first show up with Chris Claremont and Paul Smith. Actually, it's their first appearance, so I fall in love with them at first sight because they were like, oh, these are the X-Men. Oh, and these are the Morlocks. Wow. It's like it was an incredible introduction to the mutant world and lore. So I love how what the Morlocks represent in culture and in terms of subculture, and how, I mean, the whole situation where, oh, we have a mansion, you can come and live with us, or maybe not because you don't look that good and you don't look like cool mutants. So maybe you should stay here in the subways and hide hidden.
So the word Morlocks, or the phrase Morlocks, is originally from the H.G. Wells novel, The Time Machine. And there are
Exactly.
a couple of races, the Morlocks and the Eloi, who are introduced. And I don't know what the origin of the characters are, basically, but the Morlocks are the antagonists in the book. They're these little monster creatures who live underground and are going to come get you, basically. So that name has been appropriated, I think, in a lot of different places, most notably in the X-Men, I think. But H.G. Wells also used them in other versions of his books. Do you want to tell us, Patricio, a little bit about the Morlock view of the mutant world? By the way, for my long-term listeners, we've done a lot of character episodes. This isn't the first Morlock I've ever done, which is crazy to me because I love these characters.
The Morlocks is, from my point of view, is the first like culture, like the first mutant society that we see on comic books in terms of culture and what they do together. I mean, we know how we have Krakoa now on comic books, but I think the first time we are introducing to a mutant culture is the Morlocks, because they live as a tribe. They're not a super team. They're not trying to be super villains or to conquer the world. They just want to survive. So they are this created family where they have to gather together because they don't have any other choice. They don't have a passing. They can't go on the streets and pretend to be human. So in many ways, it's so connected to the queer community. It's very interesting how we have these mutants who are more like an elite of mutants, and then we have the other mutants who are not that cool. That, I mean, Storm could be on the cover of Vogue magazine if she wants to. I don't know, Mask, Plague, Caliban. No, they can't. I mean, it's impossible for them. And they have this sort of community, and they have their rules, they have their way of living, they have their traditions. For me, it's amazing. It's incredible. I wish some writers will keep on developing what the Morlocks symbolism is in terms of society and culture, because I adore the whole mythos. And I think Claremont was very, very intelligent when he decided to create the Morlocks in terms of symbolism and what they represent in society.
The Morlocks are amazing. They are found family at the nth degree. They give me a lot of, so they were created in the mid 80s, right? And they give me a lot of almost, this isn't probably the right comparison, but did you guys ever see The Lost Boys? It's kind of this, you know, we run away from home and we form our own society by our own rules. We're watching, a lot of people are watching the show Yellow Jackets right now, which is the girls in the woods, you know, who have to form their own society. The Morlocks almost give that kind of energy. We're going to leave things behind and do things on our terms, but also let's make it fashion. They live in the abandoned subway tunnels underneath New York City, and they've established, even though they've left society behind, they've established their own rules in the way that we've later seen expanded in Genosha and Araco and Krakoa. We're going to form society by our rules. We're going to welcome anyone who belongs. If you are dangerous, if you are ugly, if you don't fit, even if your powers are not super, like, we're going to create a space where you are safe. And I can't imagine living in those concrete tunnels under New York City, but they make it work. And there's a whole society of how that happens. Now, in the early 2000s, I was a college student long before I was out. I was getting ready to write on the Marvel handbooks, and I used to write a lot of X-Men stories just like I do now. And I remember developing a whole like origin story for the Morlocks and how they came to be. And Beautiful Dreamer was a big part of that. So this is a character that I've had in my brain for a really long time. I really like her.
I think it's very, very interesting that they show that even though we don't belong, and I put it in quotes, they belong with each other. They belong to each other. They are a family. And the juxtaposition of them as the family versus, like Patricio was saying, like the cool X-Men. And it's interesting because some of them that do have, some of them are very powerful. I mean, Beautiful Dreamer has a very powerful ability. Annabelle, a very powerful ability. Torpid, you know, who's basically Rogue in like a tiny little form. You know what I mean? They and Caliban, he's a walking Cerebro.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, there are people that, these are people that look different, and they are the epitome of don't judge a book by its cover. And I find it very, very interesting that you have the Morlocks who are, quote, like undesirables, yet later we have the X-Men taking in people like Bling or Beak and people like Rockslide, people like that, who would, just by looking at them, you would think, or Glob Herman even, like looking at them, you would think, what?
Or Dupe.
Yeah, exactly. You would think that these are the people that should be with the Morlocks. And yet they never invite the Morlocks. And I think that if they ever turned around and tried to, they'd be like, no, I'm not going to do it. And we kind of explore that in Laura Kinney Wolverine number 7. After Laura and Beautiful Dreamer escape, Laura says, where are you going? And she's like, you know, about to go through into a sewer tunnel. She's like, where are you going? She's like, you know, there's a place for you up here. No, there's not.
Yeah.
There's no place for me up here. And it's not just because of the way she looks. She says, when I come up here, everybody exploits me for my abilities. Everybody wants that perfect world. And all that does is make me feel terrible and shittier about the world that I live in. And I think that that's really important. And I think that's a very important perspective that people need to think about, especially with social media and with everything that we see.
There's a lot of intense Morlock stories. A lot of it's about their destruction, their persecution, the Morlock massacre, obviously, when Mikhail floods the tunnels and takes them all to the hill, even on Krakoa, where they're expected to coexist alongside the Marauders. So So each of these characters, though, has their own origin story. And this is where we love queerness in the X-Men, but queerness in the Morlocks, boy, could we write a lot of stories there. Every one of these characters came from somewhere. So some of them, if you live in New York and you can't qualify for an apartment because of the way you look, and you can't get a job or an address or a phone, and also you're not safe living as an unhoused person because of the way you look, like, where are you gonna go, right? And so to form secret societies, there are a lot of, by the way, homeless communities or unhoused communities out there where people will form networks and they watch out for each other. And there's kind of a ranking of here's how you behave and here's how you get along and here's the standards that you live by and here's where we draw the line. And we don't think of that, but if you talk to anyone who's ever been unhoused, you'll learn that in various cities there are various networks of resources for people to survive and be together. For example, I lived in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho for several years before moving to Salt Lake City. I worked a lot with the homeless, and there was one particular encampment where in the winter, because there's cold there, they would all dig graves for each other. They would call them graves. They would call them places where they'd sleep, and they would line the graves in cardboard and then put a covering on top. Because when people wanted to sleep, they could pull the covering aside, sleep inside in the cardboard, and stay relatively warm and in their enclosed space. And then they would pull the cardboard back in the mornings and be able to interact and build fires and interact together. And there was certain parts of community, there were initiation rites to get in, and they were some pretty good people, right? So it kind of depends. It's an interesting thing to view. So every one of these characters came from somewhere. Some of them didn't fit. Some of them are escaping tragedy. Some of them just didn't fit into the wider world. And some of them are really awful people. That's what makes it fun too, because there's some real monsters down there, not metaphorically, but like real actual monsters. If you guys all pick like one or two favorites, who are the characters among the Morlocks that are you're like, oh, this is my character. I love this person.
I like Facade and I like Beautiful Dreamer.
The first one you said?
Facade.
Facade. Yeah.
I like that idea of like being able to be that fly on the wall, like literally,
You're
you
talking about
know.
Tommy,
No, not Tommy. Tommy's the paper
the
thin
vapor.
girl. Tommy's paper thin and she has the rainbow hair. Facade can literally like become the wall, become the floor, become.
Oh, where was it
Oh,
introduced?
Facade is from X-Men Evolution specifically. The cartoon.
Oh, he's specifically from. Oh,
Yeah.
okay.
So
My
he
apologies.
no, you can count Facade. It just took me a minute to
Yeah.
connect. So Facade is one of the Morlocks from X-Men Evolution in 2002. Yeah, that's a really interesting one. And I lied, by
Okay.
the way. I said I've never done a Morlock. I did a Tommy episode once. That's
Okay, so there you
I
go.
lied.
But
How about
Tommy's great
you?
too.
Oh,
Okay.
Tommy's amazing. Yeah. Patricio, who are your favorites?
Tommy, I love her. I don't know why we have this. I've told you before. I don't know why people in the queer community has this connection with Tommy. It's so like tragic and so amazing the way she looks. It's incredible. She has this only one appearance, and people fall in love with her immediately.
There's more than one now. But yeah, she's painted in the colors of the trans flag. She's a gorgeous girl with hair. Jordan Olsen did a Tommy cosplay a few years ago that was amazing. Jordan, we
Amazing.
love you. Yeah, Tommy's really fascinating. I'm really connected to the character Caliban in an odd way. Caliban was a character, he was in that kind of dumb, like, I don't know who I am, member of X-Force phase when I was first buying comics, and I really imprinted, and I've shared this on the show before, but I had a series of fish all through my high school years and my 20s, and all of my fish were named
Well.
Caliban. Just a funny connection. I also like some of the weird ones. Like, you guys know Bliss, like the girl that like spits her tongue out and it's her own face on her tongue. Like, I love some of the weird characters. Callisto, of course, is amazing. There's a lot of them that I really care about. I also just released an Artie Maddox episode. We talk about Leech a lot in that one. There's some good stuff. So we're gonna jump to the world of Power Pack to open here. So Louise Simonson is writing Power Pack with June Brigman in the 1980s, and she's bringing in a lot of like the X-Men stuff. You guys remember the Morlock Massacre, where there's like the infamous issue of X-Men where Wolverine's teaming up with like 5-year-old Katie Power, and they're, fighting monsters together. The kids are like lost in the tunnels. So Power Pack are little kids who are super powered by aliens, and they get lost in the tunnels quite often. They're having a lot of very dangerous adventures. Child protection should be called, is all I'm saying. So Louise Simonson and June Brigman create a lot of Morlock characters who Chris Claremont later pick up in Power Pack number 12. The Power Pack kids are rescuing a kitten who's been lost in the sewer, and they're worried about alligators down there. And they do meet alligators because they're being controlled by the Morlock named Piper, not to be confused with the Savage Land Mutate character, Piper. And we'll talk about him in a second. They also meet a whole bunch of new Morlocks, and they all seem kind of like archetypes of people that you might have met on the streets in New York in the 1980s, which is funny. So Piper, to me, kind of looks like Fizzywig from the old Christmas Carol. He's like a little portly guy with a terrible beard and like a little happy flute that he can control animals with. We've got Erg, and Erg is a unit of energy measurement. Erg is like a punk in like stripped clothes, black mohawk, eye patch. He has to lift his patch to fire blasts out of his eyes. He's got a dog collar on. He absorbs energy and then reblasts it. And this one's a little problematic. We got a character named Tar Baby. It was the 80s. Tar Baby's not a great name, but the phrase delicately means kind of a sticky situation, like one that gets worse when you try to solve it. But this has also been used as a racial slur for black people forever. Go back to Song of the South and the Br'er Rabbit story. Tar Baby in the Morlock Tunnels, I think, is white, but he's also maybe made of tar and also dressed in punk clothes. But he's just kind of like a sticky dude who's got like junk and trash stuck all over him. He kind of looks like a character you might see in like Fat Albert, like the cartoon in the 80s in an odd way. We've also got Ape. Ape seems to be a character who's intellectually disabled. He's a mutant who just wears kind of scraps of clothing and like an I Love New York beanie. And he can shapeshift into different objects. He'll turn into a chair, a vase, whatever, trash can. We've got Anna Lee. This is the covered in scorpions infamous episode from the X-Men animated series. She's giving like major bag lady energy, like hair in curls, and she can manipulate your emotions by touching you. We've got Mask, who's in a hood, who is very misshapen and can like twist your flesh. We've got Leech, who can cancel your powers, and he's a little green frog guy, kind of. He's a little cutie. And then we've got Beautiful Dreamer.
I adore how she looks. She looks so like all Hollywood in many ways. Like I think she used to be like this Hollywood all star, you know, that she fell from grace, and then now she's trying to rebuild her life. I feel she has this amazing like long pink red dress with these patches, and she's covering her face. I don't know if that's because Mask did something to her, or because she's ashamed of the way she looks. I don't know. She has this whole mysterious thing about her that I love, and I love the fact that she's always smoking with it, because her powers, I think they're called mind smoke or something like that. The way she uses her powers.
She's very tall. She's very, very
Very slim,
thin.
like yeah.
Yeah, and she wears like a lanky pink dress, like with patches. There's like a big
Yeah.
pink
It's almost
bow
like a slip
tip.
dress.
Yeah.
Yeah, slip dress. Yeah.
It's
Like a slip
giving
dress,
very
yeah.
like 1920s film star. I agree with you, Patricio. It's like very old Hollywood
Yeah,
flapper
from the
girl,
early
kind of
20s. Yeah,
almost. There's a big pink bow at the hip. She's got like strings of pearls around her neck, black gloves, fur stole on her shoulders. And then there's that characteristic. She's got the hat. Sometimes it's black, sometimes it's pink. It's like pulled
depends.
down over her eyes, and then the lace netting covers her face. So she's giving like, I don't know, it's giving like Greta Garbo, who was like in a bunch of movies and was super famous. But then one day they put out the Grand Hotel because talk movies have come out now, right? And everyone's like, Garbo speaks. And then when she speaks, and everyone's like, oh, she sounds different than I expected. And she's, I want to be alone. And then Garbo goes into hiding, and maybe she moved to the Morlock tunnels. That's kind of my origin. And then, yes, there's always the single cigarette in her fingers, the
In the single
swirling
cigarette.
energy. Patricio, the cover for this episode is going to be the character redesign that you did for Beautiful Dreamer. Do you want to talk about your inspirations there at all?
Because you know back then when we used to have the Hellfire Gala from Krakoa, I used to do some fan art, and I usually pick Morlocks because I think they deserve to be there. I can help it. I love the Morlocks. So I decided to create this whole glamour look for her. I think she's very glamorous. I love her in the way she's mysterious and glamorous. So I wanted to give her this very over the top in terms of volume. I always try to pick elements from the original look and turn them into something new and something huge and glamorous. So that was my take, more or less, to what I tried to do with her and the other Morlocks in terms of the gala, the Krakoa Hellfire Gala.
She's fabulous. It's giving very like Project Runway. Like the category is like street chic, but you have to use only items you found in the trash outside of
Exactly.
the thrift store.
Yeah.
Like it's fantastic.
They're leaked.
Yes.
They're leaked.
And
And
bold.
then Erica, do you want to tell us about Beautiful Dreamer's powers? They work kind of in an odd way, but the visual on her is stunning.
Well, basically, in the OG Beautiful Dreamer, she had this cigarette usually in like one of those cigarette holders. And so she would have that and she would blow the smoke at you. And as she blew the smoke at you, it would then, whatever she felt she wanted you to see, feel, experience, she would basically be manipulating your reality. And it wouldn't be physically happening to you, but you would be so in your own head that you would feel that this was all real. Unfortunately, we can't have smoking anymore in comics. And when Giada and I were working on issue number 7, they said that we can't have her smoke. So that idea of her power being linked to the cigarettes couldn't happen. So we had to think of something else. So we have the smoke sort of coming off of her fingertips, kind of like the motion of smoking, you know, but the smoke is coming off of her fingertips as opposed to her blowing the smoke from the cigarette
Yeah, I almost love the
because you
idea.
can't
Like
smoke.
the cigarette's just the tool. Like the smoke comes from her. That's fun for me.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about the variants for this character very quickly. We'll do this all in one. There's three variants on this character that I'm aware of, and that's all. One of them is in a weird all ages book called Marvel Age Spider-Man Team Up, where they run into the Morlocks in this book, and there's a version of Dreamer, but it's like a 17-year-old girl with short red hair who has similar powers. For those of you that have seen the show The Gifted, there's a character named Dreamer in that show. This is live action. Yeah, her real name is Sonya Simonson. She is played by Alina Satine, and she has this kind of memory reading, memory implantation, memory erasure through like smoke powers, but she gets killed in an early episode. I think she's in 10 episodes of the show. And then the last one we see is if you guys remember the Manites, this is deep nerd Marvel lore. The Manites were in like the late 90s of the X-Men. They're like weird superpowered kids. And this is not the same character, but there's a little creepy pink baby with purple eyes named Beautiful Dreamer as well. So those are the variants for this character. Beautiful Dreamer does not have a lot of content that is specific to her. She's usually in the background, but there's a lot of serious Morlock stories. So I'm going to let Patricio kind of talk about her key moments in her first appearance in Power Pack and then in Uncanny X-Men 195.
Actually, it's like a one issue. Both issues are the same story. So they use Beautiful Dreamer to try to change the kids' minds in order to keep them with Annalee, because Annalee just lost her children in Power Pack. But actually, in X-Men, they were killed by Grey Crow, the member of the Marauders.
Yeah,
So.
Psylocke's boyfriend Grey Crow gunned down some kids, and these were like the ones that the bag lady with the memory powers like adopted, and so she's grieving, obviously, and now she re wants to rewrite the memories of the Power Pack kids to be her own children.
Yeah, I never get why people like to redeem Grey Crow. He's a child killer. I can't stand that. I'm sorry. I have to say it because I have so many discussions about Grey Crow, and I can't help thinking about the fact that he killed so many children during the Mutant Massacre. So,
He also shot Madeline Pryor in the head one time.
yeah, he did. He's a horrible, horrible character. I hate it. But actually, well, she's grieving. She's very sad, and her powers are affecting the whole Morlock community. That's why they keep her near Leech, because they need to neutralize their powers together. Because the Morlocks can't stand poor little Leech. They hate him because his powers turn off all the mutants, all the Morlocks' powers too. So they're trying to kidnap the Power Pack kids in Power Pack. That's when we get introduced to Beautiful Dreamer. She's very shy, she's very coy, she's very like not very extrovert. Actually, she has second thoughts about using her powers because she knows that it's against the law. Because now the tribe leader is not Callisto anymore, it's Storm. It's forbidden to attack any people from the surface, but they feel so sad about what's going on with Annalee that they go on with the plan and they try to kidnap the kids. And after that, the Nightcrawler and Kitty Pryde with an amazing orange new costume show up, which is very weird. I never understood if they decided to change Kitty's costume because Power Pack was for children, so they wanted to give her bright colors to showcase her in the book. But I love that orange costume that she never ever used again ever in her life. Crawler and Kitty are in the tunnel, so they realize that something is strange going on with the Morlocks and those kids, because they already told them that Annalie kids are dead. So they said, so what's going on? Why are these kids with the Morlocks? And so they go and they find out that they're trying to kidnap Power Pack. They stop them. So that's what happens in Power Pack. You guess that the drain deal dealers had enough, but they decided to keep on kidnapping the
Yeah,
Power Pack.
there's like a faction of the Morlocks called the
Yeah.
Drain Dwellers that kind of live apart from the others. This is the characters like Berserker and Scaleface, and yeah, well, they're worthy of their own episode sometime. They're fun.
Yeah, they have these factions between the Morlocks. They have the Tunnelers, the Tunnelers, which are more aggressive, which are Berserk, Scaleface, Mask, and there's another one, Blowhard. Those are the ones who are the Tunnelers. And then we
Which is a
have,
hilarious name for the gay community, Blowhard.
we can do a whole episode about names and characters. Like, what were they thinking? And then we have the other Morlocks, which are the more like, these ones, which are, I don't know, they hate each other. Actually, the Tunnelers can't stand this team. They think they are very pathetic and they don't like them. So they failed to kidnap the kids, and actually you thought that everything was over, but then you have to go to Uncanny X-Men, and then you find out that they did something horrible to the Power Pack family and to the Powers, which are Louise Simonson and Walter Simonson. They were based on them, actually. I think the Power Pack's parents were based on them. And then you move to Uncanny X-Men and you find out that the kids wake up in their parents' beds, and actually their parents do not know who they are because their minds have been wiped by our beautiful dreamer. So the kids run out to the streets. I don't know why they ran out to the streets. That's something kids. You have to be smarter. They decided to sleep on the streets in the middle of the night in Manhattan. That's in the 80s. It's like, what is going on?
This could be a
Not the
horror.
smartest things.
No.
This could be a horror comic, but I almost want to read it more like an episode of the Golden Girls. Like Beautiful Dream and Annalie are best buds, and they're just gonna go get some kids. You know, it's fine.
It's
My
so like,
God.
I don't know, because actually the Power Pack kids, they have many friends among the superhero communities, the superhero community, so they could call them or reach them in any sort of way, but they decided to sleep on the middle of the street in an alley. It's like, kids, you need to think carefully before you take these decisions, especially the older ones. Because I mean, Julie is only like, how old is she?
Yeah,
Five
like
year old.
five. It's crazy.
She's almost a toddler. She's so young. But the other ones, I mean, they are 13, 11. How old are they?
And yeah,
Yeah,
I
they're not exactly the most responsible of
No.
older
They're
siblings.
like
Yeah.
11, 9, 7, and 5 or something. And the art back then, it's very sweet. And I've interviewed June Brigman. I would love to interview Louise Simonson. It's one of my top dream interviews, actually. But there's a lot of images of like the kids walking around in just like underwear. Like
Yeah.
the little girls like have no shirts on and they're just like hanging out in the bathtub. And you're like, oh, this is a different time.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
It's a strange shift, isn't it? The parent who raised you needs some help, and you want to be there. With Care.com, you don't have to do it alone. Whether you're clear on the kind of care your aging loved one needs or still figuring it out, we've got support. Find background-checked in-home senior caregivers for anything from companionship to dementia care. Or browse senior living communities, read reviews, even schedule a tour. Plus, access to safety checks to help with your peace of mind. Still not sure what's best? Our senior care advisors, who are all master's level social workers, can help you build a plan. For a limited time, use the code LISTEN20 for 20% off your initial care.com subscription. That's LISTEN20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
If you need something quick and convenient like my family does, My ultimate high-protein dinner hack is grabbing pre-marinated steak tips and making them extra crispy and charred in the air fryer, while the inside stays juicy and medium rare. I can't say enough about the convenience of Omaha Steaks. Thanks to them, I always have the highest quality proteins on hand. Enjoy exceptional flavor in the convenience of Omaha Steaks during their Spring Savings event. Omaha Steaks is your weeknight win. And right now, you can get the world's best everyday protein during their Spring Savings event. Go to omahasteaks.com for an extra $35 off when you use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to shop their Spring Savings event and use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
I love June's art. I want to say something that I really like about Beautiful Dreamer is that she was created by two female comic book artists. And in her first appearance, we have three female comic book artists in that book. We have Glynis Oliver, June Brickman, and Louise Simonson, which is, I think, is amazing if you think about the 80s. I mean, it's incredible to have three powerhouse creators working together doing that book. I was so amazed by that when I was younger, when I was a kid. I said, these are three women working together, creating a comic book, a superhero comic book. This is so, that was so unique and so special to me. Because back then, for me, comic books were done by men and just by men. And when I found out that these were three women working on a comic book, I say, this is unique. And I never seen this before in my life. I mean, if, for me, it was like, I don't know.
It's fantastic. And June's, it's fantastic. June's not your typical comic book artist as well. I really enjoy her pencils. I think she's phenomenal.
So delicate. So she has this finesse in terms of how she draw. So organic. So, I don't know. It's so, in a way, light, in a nice way. Like, everything, like, flows when she draw. I love her work.
There's a running gag about how anytime a baby shows up in a comic book, it just looks like an old, terrible, like, nobody draws babies well, but June Brickman draws kids really well. They look like children. It's amazing.
Well, let's say that the Power Pack kids had to deal with masks during the Uncanny issue, so their faces are changed. But if you compare what's going on Uncanny X-Men and what's going on Power Pack in terms of how they are drawn, I mean, you can actually tell how hard it was for Romita Jr. to do the kids as young kids and not these sort of small people. I don't know. It was very like bizarre. And actually, Power Pack has this amazing list of artists. Like, I know I'm saying this okay in English. John Bogdanov.
Bogdanov.
Bogdanov and Joe Brickman are amazing doing kids, both of them. So Power Pack. Luckily, Power Pack has these two artists on the book. And I mean, if you look at the Power Pack issues from Bogdanov, you can tell that he used references from his own son to create Franklin Richards, to draw Franklin Richards. So the faces are incredible. They are kids. You are actually looking at kids in the book, which is, I think, is amazing.
Speaking of Franklin Richards, I did a whole Franklin Richards episode, which means I've read his whole history. And my best friend, Seth Martell, every time I would come across an image of, like, baby Franklin Richards, I would text it to him. And he's like, oh, stop it. I hate when artists and comic artists draw babies. It was a really fun game for me to play.
Franklin in Fantastic Four in the 80s. Oh, my God.
Okay. So back to Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah, sorry. So the kids are kidnapped again. They went to the tunnels to look for the Morlocks because they realized that actually their parents' minds had been manipulated by Beautiful Dreamer. So they decided to go back to the tunnels. Bad idea, kids. And the Morlocks are waiting for them. Actually, Beautiful Dreamer doesn't have much of a bit much. I mean, she's very important in terms of the plot, but she doesn't appear that much in the issue until the end. So what ends up happening is that Julie manages to escape from the tunnels, but her face is all like misshapen by a mask. And I think there's a policeman that finds her in the middle of the street, and she uses her powers on the policeman. So she's taken by the police, and she's on the TV on the news, And Kitty Pryde preparing breakfast in the morning, and she said, "Oh, I know this girl. This girl is not a mutant. She's Julie Powers from the Power Pack." So she decides to rescue her from, I think she's in a hospital, I'm not sure. She decides to create this small group of X-Men to rescue Julie from the hospital, and she has Rachel Summers, Rogue, and Wolverine. I think
now Kitty is also someone who, as a young teen, was kidnapped by the Morlocks, and they tried to force her to marry Caliban that one time. So, you know, she understands what's happening.
Yeah, she says, "Oh, same old song. let me handle this. I know what's going on here." She's very like, "Oh, I love the Morlocks, but they're so problematic. I mean, why do they keep kidnapping young kids? I mean, what's going on, kids? Come on, stop." So she decides to create this small group of X-Men. I love this X-Men. I love this team. I love Rachel Summers. She's one of my favorite X-Men. And I love that she's wearing leggings and all that 80s outfit. I love warmers and stuff like that. I love that look. So she
very flash dance.
Yes, flash dance. Exactly. Flash dance. Yeah. Exactly. She looks amazing. And Wolverine decides Wolverine decides that Kitty is going to be the X-Men leader for this mission. So the 15 years old kid from the team now is the leader of the team, because Wolverine has these amazing ideas all of a sudden that make no sense. So Kitty now is leading the team to the Morlock tunnel where she was kidnapped a few months ago. So everything is very, you know, nice for her.
Well, I also get the vision of, like, Kitty's just been nagging him, like, "Oh my God, when do I get to lead a mission? When do I get to lead a mission?" He's like, "Fine, here you go, kid.
Here we go. This is the mission. Your trauma. This is
the mission. Relive your trauma, exactly.
Relive your trauma, girl. Here, you will prove if you are ready or not for the mission." So they go back to the Morlock tunnels, searching for the power pack kids. And the thing is, Beautiful Dreamer decided to erase their minds and create new personalities for the kids. And they believe they are Annalise children now. And they're looking like tiny Morlocks with their own punk clothing and belts and chains and stuff like that, which I think it was very, very, it was hilarious when I saw that. I love the looks. In terms of fashion, the Morlocks are the coolest. I love how the Morlocks look. And actually, the Morlocks influenced the X-Men in the 80s, and they start dressing like the Morlocks after they meet them. It's very like what's going on in queer culture, where these very famous queer people meet other people from other subcultures, and they pick different things from the style and music and art, and then they make all that mainstream. Well, I think it's very similar what's going on here. They face the Morlocks, and there's a whole confusion because most of the Morlocks think that those are actually Morlock kids and not the power, and not Power Pack. So they think that the X-Men are trying to get their own kids. This whole thing becomes like too violent, because all of a sudden Wolverine decides to use claws to fight the Morlocks, which I think is very like, what are you doing? Why are you fighting the Morlocks with your own claws? You are too much danger. You are so dangerous and so lethal. Why are you trying to kill these people? They fight, and all of a sudden Callisto decided to show up and say, "What is going on here? Kids, behave. What's going on?" She tells Beautiful Dreamin' to restore the Power Pack kids' minds and to get rid of all the furniture that the Morlocks have stolen from the Power Pack's family. It's very sad, actually, because Annalie gets so, so sad, and she asks Callisto to do a trial by combat so she can die and be with her children. And I that broke my heart. I really like this issue. I really like this area.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's fantastic. I mean, I'm telling and narrating the whole thing, laughing and all, but when I read this issue, it was so heartbreaking for me, because I could tell how much in pain Annalie was because of the loss of her children, and how hard it was for her to be alive after what happened to her family. The way she asked Cal to, "Let's go to trial by combat. I want to die. I don't want to live in a world where I don't have my children." Oh my God, that was so hard, so hard. But I really like the issue. I really enjoy it. And actually, it was so cute how Julie decided to forgive Annalie and to say, "I can visit you if you need me. I can be with you if you need me." She's so sweet. The girl is so sweet. And Claremont has this thing with dialogues, which is amazing. So I really enjoy the issue. I really like Kitty in the issue too. I love her. She's one of my favorite X-Men too. I don't know why Rachel all of a sudden disappears in the middle of the issue and show up in the end. I was hoping to see more of her. I think that has to do with her not being able to use her psi powers in the tunnels because they have all this like mental blocks and stuff like that going on because of all the mental powers they have, the Morlocks have. That's it.
Before we jump to the next big story, I want to talk about the backstory of the Morlocks for just a moment. Okay, first of all, if we are casting the Morlocks as a Golden Girls episode, I think we get Anna Lee as Sophia. I think we get Callisto as Dorothy. I think we get Caliban as Rose, and then Beautiful Dreamer is, of course, Blanche, right? You get the opening credits, and there's a whole thing, which is really fun. We also do, like, we support women's wrongs, we support, like, be gay, do crimes kind of era. I'm kind of wondering, we don't know the backstory for a lot of these characters, but I'm kind of wondering if the Morlocks as a society, it's never been stated on the page directly, but if they realize something is wrong, like, we need a light source, we need someone who can protect us, we need someone to, like, do they kidnap mutants from the surface? And Beautiful Dreamer, like, Caliban tracks them down, and Beautiful Dreamer rewrites their memories, and Mask, like, reshapes their flesh, and it's their way of keeping their society bolstered up. There's a Morlocks as villain spin here that I think is really interesting, and you kind of wonder who doesn't know. We don't know anything about Beautiful Dreamer's origins, but just consider that. So right after this, we have the Morlock Massacre, and we have Sinister, who we don't really have fleshed out at this point, hiring the Marauders, who is an incredible team of diverse assassins. They're all fantastic, even though they're horrible, horrible people, going in to wipe out the Morlocks. And we don't really know why. It's almost giving kind of, I've been talking about fascism a lot, like, let's go wipe out the undesirables, like slaughter everyone. Later writers will retcon putting Beast from the Age of Apocalypse, who like came over to our world 20 years ago, and he somehow had a hand in the Morlock formation. And
Dark Beast.
Sugar Man somehow had a formation in Genosha, and you almost wonder if like Sinister is sending the Marauders in to like get Dark Beast back. Anyway, the Morlock Massacre happens. Do the two of you have a favorite Marauder? I'm really partial.
They all suck.
They all suck, but they're all amazing. I'm really partial to Scrambler. His powers are just so weird that I want to play with him all the time. Like I want to do shit with his powers all the time.
I do enjoy visually the Marauders. I love that they only have one shoulder. Like all the designs are like asymmetrical. I love that in terms of fashion sense. Like, look, we look cool, but we're gonna be jerks.
My best buddy Seth really loves Vertigo. Like, that's his favorite.
I like Riptide.
Riptide, interesting. Do you have a favorite?
Honestly, I don't think I do. Because I think, honestly, I get the whole thing with their sort of asymmetrical fashion, but I never really wanted to get into the Marauders just because I always felt like I don't ever want to have to be in a situation where I have to feel any type of sympathy for them because I think they're horrible.
I mean, you're writing Laura Kinney Sabretooth coming up, so you can pick Sabretooth as your favorite Marauder.
I don't know.
So we're going to keep this focused on Beautiful Dreamer. In the X-Factor number 10, Power Pack number 27 crossover, the Morlock Massacre's there. So many people die, but Erg, ERG, and Beautiful Dreamer get saved by X-Factor. So we jump to X-Factor 12, and all of the rescued Morlocks have been brought aboard X-Factor's ship, which is the sentient, you know, celestial apocalypse ship. And they're like, they brought too many people there. There's a big cast at this point. And in X-Factor 15, we see them in a couple issues, like having a meal, and then the Morlocks go back to the tunnels. And that's the last we see Beautiful Dreamer for like 15 years. It's like a really long time before she shows up again. Do either of you have any thoughts on the Morlock Massacre that you want to share? This is a deeply impactful story, obviously. Anna Lee gets killed. A ton of characters are killed. Beautiful Dreamer survives. And we don't get any perspective from her voice. There's not a single line of dialogue, I don't think, given from this character's mouth. But she lives.
Cybele is killed, too.
Cybele, yes, who you got to.
Cybele. I love Cybele looks. She looks amazing. I like her look. I think it's very strange and funny that when she gets injured, Beautiful Dreamer is ape turns into a bed, and she's like carrying her to the X Factor headquarters in a bed. So she's a beautiful dreamer in all the sense. It's very like.
I don't know if I realized that from the art. That's a really good pickup.
It's from the Power Pack issue. She's in a bed, and Ape is a bed. And I think it's so like, I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but I thought it was amazing in terms of creating a narrative for the character. I actually feel that the Mutant Massacre, it's very like a pivotal, like very important moment in terms of what's going on in the X-Men and what's going on in the Marvel Universe. When I was a kid, I was so shocked by the Mutant Massacre. It was so like Annalise's death was shocking to me. Like it was very like I never seen something like that in a comic book. And to see all the Morlocks being slaughtered in that way, it was so heartbreaking and so like, I don't know. I think it's important in terms of what happened to the X-Men and to the comic industry after the Mutant Massacre in terms of the summer events. I think Mutant Massacre in many ways is the end of the Bronze Age of comics, in terms of the innocence, in terms of what superheroes are, in terms of the giant size X-Men, it's the end of that. And I think it's very, like, very important, and it's iconic.
Again, Power Pack was a comic about kids, for kids, by women, and we see, like, these little kids reckoning with death, right? There's, like, in Power Pack 27, there's a moment where the little kids come across, like, Annalise's corpse. And they're like, oh, sorry, Leech, your new mommy is dead. And they're like trying to help him out. Like it's pretty rough in some ways.
It's like a fixed point in time. You know what I mean? Like they can't retcon it because it made so many things. It influenced so many things, like the way Gambit is treated after this. And, you know, them dropping it, they dropped them off in the Arctic, you know, kind of thing. Like, because for, you know, you had the slightest hand in this, Gambit. Now, you know, you're dead to us kind of thing. It was interesting where when Krakoa happened and they were basically like resurrecting everybody, some of the people who were massacred, like Cybele, had a real chip on their shoulder because they were left to be killed. There was no one there to try and help them. Like, X-Men, you're heroes? Where the hell are you? You're heroes for mutants? Where the hell are you? Oh, you're heroes for the pretty mutants. Oh, now, okay, yeah, now I get it. You're heroes for the mutants who can pass.
It's a powerful version, you know? Of like Days of Future Past, because we're seeing it right on the page, yeah. Right? Like, when we unleash, look at the victims that are hurt. This is who the X-Men are there to protect, you know, in a lot of ways. Okay, jumping forward to M-Day. Scarlet Witch does no more mutants. There's 198 mutants left, and Beautiful Dreamer is one of them. She's one of the last surviving mutants on the planet. So we see her move to the grounds of the Xavier Estate, where they do the mutant encampment under the guard of Sentinels. Like, fuck Valerie Cooper for that specifically. The Office of National Emergency. Like, let's put the bigots and Sentinels to watch over the rest of the mutants. She doesn't really show up much. There's a big story in the limited series, X-Men the 198, where Mr. M is doing some crazy stuff. But after this, where the books start to expand, we get the Mercenary X-Force title, and this is the biggest Beautiful Dreamer story until Erica's most recent one. In X-Force Volume 3, Number 12, a group of the worst criminals ever, the biggest bigots, have been reanimated by the Transmode virus under the control of Bastion, and they're being sent out on little missions, trying to build to a place where all the remaining mutants in the world are going to be exterminated, and no one else will ever be born. So Graydon Creed is back in charge of the Friends of Humanity, and they're holding a public rally for the bigots who would go to a, you know, Friends of Humanity rally in Ames, Iowa. At the rally, Beautiful Dreamer has been captured by the Leper Queen, the leader of the Sapien League. It's this whole thing. And they've, like, basically injected her with the virus that she can't control. They send her running in. She's in her gorgeous, like, pink slip of a dress and, like, pink hat. It's the most visual we really ever get from her because her face is uncovered. And she's glowing pink. I was reading the books at the time, and I was so excited to see them using her. And then they did this, which, again, is powerful storytelling, but fuck. So she's glowing pink. She's in her hat and her little slinky dress. And she's infecting everyone around her with psychic energy. And this is the most words I think she's ever spoken on the page until her, again, until Erica wrote her. Please help me. help me, it's inside me, please, please, I don't want to die. And then she blows up. And the psychic energy that emanates from her body, because it's been weaponized, kills 1,100 people in the area. And it's another opportunity for the bigots to be like, look how dangerous mutants are. Rough story.
Well, I mean, this idea of the Friends of Humanity or Humanity First or whomever using a mutant's power against their will to then justify their bigotry, that is not new. That is a tact that is, you know, kind of a familiar trope in a lot of X-books. You know, turning around and saying mutants are horrible. Look at somebody like Wolverine. You know, look what all the damage that he's done. You know, of course, all mutants are horrible. And it's just painting with a broad brush. The fact that Beautiful Dreamer dies in such like a dramatic way of like blowing up, basically being an incendiary device. I mean, that is so antithetical to the aesthetic that they had created of her as this very slight, very delicate, you know, I mean, because not only the way she dressed, but she was a very, you know, she was thin. She was, you know, very, very petite, very slight, very delicate. And yet here she is expending this energy in such a bombastic way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a high body count in this era of comics. This is back when I was writing the handbooks. The image, more even more than this, that lives in my brain, they created those big monsters, the Predators X, those big like skeletal-looking monsters. And there's one where that little character, I have a whole episode on Peepers. I fucking love Peter Quinn Peepers, one of my favorites. There's an episode where Predator X like eats Peepers and spits out his skeleton. And it gave me imagery of like, well, we don't need to talk about it, but more like fascism and what they did to disabled people. Like, I really hated it. Like, yeah. No, I mean, it's playable characters and they can get killed and that's what the story is meant to do. But no, I hate it a lot. Patricio, any thoughts on Beautiful Dreamer's death?
I was so mad when I read this book because I wish they would give her some more lines or a story. I mean, this could be her end, but I wish they would give her a moment to shine.
Like, make us care about her, at least.
Yeah, because I care about her because I love caring about these characters that nobody cares about. But give her some lines, give her some, I don't know, like some spotlight. Show me who she is. Not just use her as a bomb in the middle of a place. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm being so literal, but that's the way they are using her.
We care about our characters, folks. Okay, so the X-Men Legends 11, which is the anthology title during Krakoa, we get a flashback to the time when the Horsemen Apocalypse were harassing the Morlocks and X-Factor saves them. It's a very quick appearance. Beautiful Dreamer doesn't have much to do. Then we get Steve Fox's Dark X-Men, where we see a lot of different side stories going on. And Beautiful Dreamer has moved on to a ship full of Morlocks. And the Morlocks have some interesting playtime in like X-Men Red, but this is the only time we see Beautiful Dreamer during Krakoa. The Angel has been weaponized. Archangel Warren Worthington has been weaponized and sent to slaughter the Morlocks. And several characters do really horribly die. She does survive and the X-Men jump in to save them. And then Krakoa falls. So that's all we get of Beautiful Dreamer up to this point. She hasn't even had a lot of words on the page, but she has an impact. Every little minor character has an impact. Now we jump to Laura Kinney, Wolverine, which is Erica Schultz's opus on this incredible character who grew up as a child soldier against her will, who's been turned into a weapon, who's reclaiming her life. Erica, if I can just say out loud, I appreciate you and Jed specifically for making Krakoa still feel resonant. There's a lot of writers who will use lines of dialogue on occasion, but you and Jed McKay in your books remind us continuously that Krakoa being gone is something that we need to grieve because it's really sad and the world sucks and Laura's trying to help the people who need help. Do you want to tell everybody a little bit about your Cybele story, which is lovely, of course, and then tell us about your Beautiful Dreamer story, which gives us the Badoon.
Story with Cybele is in issue number one of Laura Kinney Wolverine. I wrote it, Jed Abelvizo drew it, and Rachel Rosenberg colored it. And basically, Cybele's attitude is similar to what she said when she first was resurrected for Krakoa. She says to Wolverine, of course you wouldn't know my name. Because when Laura sort of bursts in, Cybele being the main villain, she's like, I saw you on Krakoa. She says, yeah, you don't know my name. Because just like everybody else who got killed in the mutant massacre, we were just resurrected so you could, as a PR stunt, so we could show, you know, Emma and the rest of them doing these, look how wonderful Krakoa is. Yeah, you needed more bodies to make this place look like it it's truly populated. And that's why I was resurrected. I don't care that Krakoa is gone. I'm glad Krakoa is gone. And from the way that the X-Men have always treated people like me, you can all bafanculo. You know, just all of you just piss off. Because the way that we've been treated, the way you've left us to be treated, you know, not just the way that you yourselves have treated us, but the way you have stood by and watched us literally murdered. No, screw you. I'm getting mine. She basically, and Cybele basically uses her abilities to keep people and keep mutants specifically as like human traffickers. She does that because she thinks that mutants, especially the ones that have abilities that can be exploited, she thinks that they deserve to be exploited. Because look what happened to her. Look what happened to her family, to the people that she loved. All the X-Men, all the you know, Xavier, for all of his rhetoric about, you know, humans and mutants and blah, blah, blah. Where the hell were you, Xavier? Where was Professor Charles Xavier when people were literally flooding the tunnels and allowing us to suffer and allowing us to die? Where was Professor Charles Xavier through that? You know, and that was Cybele's attitude. And then in the Beautiful Dreamer episode where we have the Badoon have a very long history of their own class war. Like you have the X-Men and the Morlocks, if you think of that in terms of a class war, and then that, you know, the Tunnelers versus, you know, the other Morlocks, they have their own sort of class, caste system, for lack of a better term. The Badoon have that themselves, and there is the lowest caste of this are the ones that are the hybrids, the ones that have been genetically messed with. And those are the ones that are really just sick and tired of being shit on. So those are the ones that are like, you know what we're going to do? We know that we can take different types of DNA. We've been experimented on before. So we're going to start pulling things. We're going to start yanking people and making sure that we can use their abilities to make ourselves better, to then go take the fight to the other two castes who forever have been on top. We're the ones who are actually powerful. So they take Beautiful Dreamer, they take Bora, they take multiple people from different planets that all have abilities that they will incorporate into themselves, incorporate into their bloodlines, to then be able to take the fight to the castes who have consistently been, you know, shitting on them for eons, and to really turn the tide of the caste system, a complete coup d'etat, and turn everything upside down. Obviously, they want Laura because of her healing abilities. With her healing abilities, it doesn't matter what the other castes throw at them. They'll heal. They can keep going. They can be relentless. They would want Beautiful Dreamer because she does have psychological, she can manipulate people. They can turn around and take the other castes, wipe their minds, and make them think that they were always the slave versus the you know, the hybrids being that. They have a sort of a righteous indignation. They, in their minds, everything that they're doing is justified. Just like Anna Lee taking Power Pack, it's justified in her head. She needs children. So that's where we brought Beautiful Dreamer into Laura Kinney Wolverine.
Beautiful Dreamer seems to try to do this humanely. She's giving Laura the best version she can of her life, which is giving very 90s sitcom. Laura's got her dad Wolverine and her little sister Gabby, and oh, they have a pet Wolverine, and it's like it's giving, I don't know, it's like very Alf.
Well, you think about it, Beautiful Dreamer has these visions of these little things, these little snippets of what she is told is the American dream. This is what makes everybody happy. So that's what she gives Laura, because in her mind, that's what surface dwellers want. They want the boyfriend or the fiance, the nice house in the suburbs, the you know, cheeky little sibling, the caring father, all of these things. That is what she's been indoctrinated to think that surface dwellers want. And Laura says, like, I didn't want a Hallmark movie. But that's what Beautiful Dreamer, in her naivete as to what the surface really is about, that's what she put Laura into.
Yeah. There's a thousand things about this character that we don't know. Her real name, her origin, her motivations, largely. But we do know that she suffered tremendous amounts of loss. I like her as the criminal. I like her as, I don't know, I like the silent film aspect energy. I like the potential and the visual of her powers. The visual is the most striking. I like her little found family connection to the early Morlocks. There's a lot to play with her. And really casting her as either, goodness, I've done a couple of different ones. I've done Greta Garbo and I've done Blanche from Golden Girls, and both of them work really well in my brain for this character. What's missing? What's the thing you need to make this character sing? Like all characters, she really deserves a moment really strongly in the spotlight. I think there's a story about her backstory that could be really, really powerful. I think, given the origins of the song that inspire her, there's some sort of significant loss where she's a character that could pass on the streets, but she chose to live in the sewers and she's escaping that loss. I also love her as a criminal. I think there's some really interesting potential for her if she chose to be a superhero, being part of the team. I feel like she and Emma Frost would get along really well if they wanted to. You know, there's some, there, Erica, sorry, I bring up Emma every time you're on my show.
It's okay.
But I feel like she would fit with a lot of different characters in really interesting ways. What's missing? What do you need?
I want to thank Erica for not killing her. I know it sounds so like, I'm sorry, but I have to say it. I was so pleased when I read the issue that she was alive after the issue ended, and she was in that horrible place after the issue ended. It was so fresh and refreshing to me to read that, because they deserve that. These characters deserve these moments, especially. And I mean, I love how you treated Sibel too, because I think all the Morlocks have different like stories that they need to live. I think the beautiful dreamer needs to sing. She needs to be a singer. She needs to express herself more. She's shy in many ways, but I like to see more her creative expression. I love to see how she is in when she's not feeling stressed or feeling sad. I think she has lots of potential. The other day when I was reading all the issues about her, which are not many, I was also watching an interview with Jinx Monsoon from Drag Race.
Oh, I'd love to see Jinx Monsoon play Beautiful Dreamer.
And I thought, oh, she will be so amazing as Beautiful Dreamer, all like the way she talks and the way she moves and the hands. I don't know. I think Jinx will be an amazing Beautiful Dreamer.
Jinx just put out in the universe that she wants to play Mystique. She's like, "I'm calling my agent. I want to play Mystique in the next movie," which is amazing.
Do you think we'll ever see the Morlocks in live action?
I think if Marvel chose to take a risk and do a series about the Morlocks, even a limited, I think it would be amazing. There was one series one time, but it wasn't the characters that we imprint on with Claremont and Simonson. It was a whole new batch, you know? So I think there's some significant potential for these characters. I would love to tell a modern story that weaves in their old origins, and make Beautiful Dreamer a huge part of that. Callisto, of course, is the main character, of course. What's missing for this character?
So when I used to teach comic book writing, I said there are four things you need to know about every character. You need to know what their name is, where they're from, what they're proud of, and what they're afraid of. We only know one thing from Beautiful Dreamer. We know what she's afraid of. We don't know what she's proud of. We don't know her name, and we don't know where she's from. So there is a lot that can be explored there. I think that in the future, I mean, who knows what'll happen these days, but in the future, it would be a disservice to not just the character, but just to the larger Marvel universe for ignoring not just Beautiful Dreamer, but a lot of these Morlocks, because they do bring a lot of richness to this universe. And like Patricio said before, the fact that they've created their own society, they've created their own tribe, it was the word that you would use, Patricio. That fact that they have that tribe, I think is so important. And I think that embellishing on that would really bring even more richness to what Marvel has right now.
Every time I finish one of these episodes, I want to go write stories about these characters. I really like this character. I'm going to associate her with the both of you forever, which makes me smile huge. Where can people find you both online, and anything you'd like to plug for early October 2025? Grey Malkin Lane, please watch for Grey Malkin underscore Lane on Instagram, where we are consistently putting out regular content and advertising the current stuff in the show. On the main show in October, we're going to be introducing Sabretooth to the show. So we're going to be having some conversations about Victor Creed. It's the mid-70s, so we get to expand our roster just a little bit. Erica will be joining me for one of those conversations, and watch for an episode featuring Tony Fleeks as well, which I'm very excited about.
You can find me on Instagram, Patricio Oliver, and you can find me on Young Men in Love, New Romance, the new anthology. I'm there with Luciano Vecchio and Al Elwin. I'm so proud of being that book. And yeah, we have Capstone Publishing has just released a new book called Mary Read, Bold Pirate in Disguise from Notorious Pirates Graphics. So it's a new book. I'm the illustrator. I'm the comic book artist from that book. So you can find that too on.
You can find me on Instagram at Erica Schultz Writes. You can find me on Blue Sky, Erica Schultz 42. And if this is October, then you will have Laura Kinney Sabretooth will be in stores, and I will be at New York Comic Con at table B13 in Artist Alley.
Just decided today, by the way, Eric, I'll see you there. So let's get together. Yay.
Absolutely.
All right, everybody. It's so good to see you both. Thank you. Every time I make this show, it just makes the world okay. So I'm so happy to have spent this time with you both. Thank you. Thank you for your time and talents. Everybody, thanks for listening and your ongoing support. We will see you all back here next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon channel. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. The Smith Act, formally known as the Alien Registration Act of 1940, was passed by the United States Congress on June 28, 1940, during a period of global instability as war raged in Europe. The law required non-citizen adults to register with the federal government and be fingerprinted. More controversially, it made it a criminal offense to knowingly advocate, abet, or teach the overthrow of the U.S. government by force or by violence, or to organize or be a member of any group dedicated to such aims. The legislation reflected rising anxieties about fascist and communist movements abroad and the possibility of subversion at home. In the early years, the act was used primarily against far-right and fascist groups. In 1941, members of the Trotskyist Socialist Workers' Party were prosecuted under the law for alleged advocacy of violent revolution. During World War II, federal authorities also used the act against individuals suspected of fascist sympathies. However, after the war, enforcement shifted dramatically. As tensions within the Soviet Union intensified, the Smith Act became a central legal tool in the emerging Cold War climate. Beginning in 1948, leaders of the Communist Party USA were indicted and convicted under the act for conspiring to advocate the violent overthrow of the government. In the landmark 1951 Supreme Court case Dennis versus the United States, the court upheld these convictions, ruling that the gravity of the potential harm justified restrictions on speech, even if the threat was not immediate. The decision marked a high point in the government's ability to prosecute political speech under national security grounds and contributed to the broader atmosphere of anti-communist repression associated with the early Cold War. And then we had McCarthyism. By the mid-1950s, however, judicial attitudes began to shift. In Yates versus the United States, 1957, the Supreme Court significantly narrowed the scope of the Smith Act, distinguishing between abstract advocacy of ideas and direct incitement to action. The ruling made it far more difficult to prosecute individuals simply for belonging to radical political organizations. Over time, the Smith Act prosecutions declined, and the law's most controversial speech-related provisions became largely dormant. The act remains on the books, but its historical significance lies primarily in its role during a period when fears of internal subversion reshaped the boundaries between national security and civil liberties in the United States. And this is also the era of the Japanese internment camps, which we won't talk about today. Now we're going to jump over to the world of X-Men Legacy. This is the Cy Spurrier Legion series, which later becomes its own television series based on this book. Issues 10 through 12, we're in the middle of the Axis event where the Red Skull is going crazy and anti-mutant and has Charles Xavier's brain, but also Legion, who's the son of Charles Xavier and Gabrielle Haller, the Jewish war survivor from the concentration camps, also has created an evil version of Charles Xavier in his mind because his power is to project personalities. So there's a lot of weird layers going on here. An evil Xavier in his mind that's known colloquially as Professor Y, but he's not a telepath, he's a precog, and he's predicted a deadly future where Legion's capable of genocide, and Legion wants to stop that. So in this series, he goes, or in this three-parter, he goes to the Institute of Biosocial Studies, the IBSS, who have developed a painful new cure for the mutant gene, and he meets the director of the program, who's a disabled man named Marcus Glove, who turns out to be a puppet of the Red Skull, who, if you recall, has Charles Xavier's brain and is a telepath. So with all of this, despite there being 42 other plot lines going on, we're gonna jump straight into X-Men Legacy number 12, where a group of X-Men attack, and the Red Skull gives them a vision of the future that he's always hoped for. Using an inciting event meant to spread his goal of subjugation against minorities and then use that to conquer the world. The simple catchphrase, "something must be done," is spreading around the populace. But Legion has a plan. His friend Santi Sardina, a little known mutant who can turn public opinion, basically, if you've done something that you got credit for, her power is to take that credit and deliver it to herself, which is a crazy kind of escapade style power that kind of fucks with your head a little bit. And she takes all of the Red Skull's victories for herself. So, and then the public opinion turns against him. He's furious. "Bastards," the Red Skull yells. And the caption tells us, "The Skull is bitterness and fury. He stands alone. His is the strength and simplicity of focused authority. He is the seductive charm of unilateral personal power. His is the way of the dictator, loved and feared." There's a superhero battle, and the Red Skull escapes on a jetpack. To be continued next time. Let me welcome one of my favorite people, Kaylin Bhatia, to the show to talk to me about this crazy story. Kaylin, are you a Red Skull fan, my friend?
I don't think anybody should be a Red Skull fan. If I met a Red Skull fan, I'd probably want to stay far away from them. But I think he's a very good villain, if that's what you're asking. But Chad, so glad to be back. Hope you're doing well.
Do you prefer your Red Skull with a jetpack or with the brain of Charles Xavier?
Both. I think all villains should have jetpacks. I'm a big fan of like the Sean Connery era, James Bond movies. And like, I think like a jetpack makes everything better. And this era of like Marvel, you know, it was Axis, as you mentioned. It was also like on the heels of AVX, the whole like, you know, Red Skull getting a hold of Charles Xavier's brain after he's killed by Cyclops and AVX happened in Rick Remender's Uncanny Avengers. So I thought it was like a really neat way of making Red Skull like more than just a Captain America villain, making him more of a bigger Marvel villain, the same way that Marvel has done with Doctor Doom, although I always think Doctor Doom is an anti-hero. I think Red Skull becoming an X-Men villain is highly underrated, and I think we got to see a lot of that in these issues of X-Men Legacy.
Doctor Doom is nuts, but he's a Romani kid who overthrew an oppressive government so he could create his own. Complicated.
You know, he gave everybody universal health care. He protects his citizens. You know, he's actually a pretty good despot. He's just, you know, his rivalry with Reed Richards is what makes him a villain. Red Skull is a straight up fucking Nazi. So yeah, like yeah. Truly a villain.
Now, when we take the Sentinels as kind of the template of anti-mutant hatred, we use them as the symbols. And then we get the Days of Future Past storyline with all of those like images. This is taking that, but putting the Red Skull's face on it, specifically while using the brain of Charles Xavier. Charles Xavier's son is the child. His mother is a concentration camp survivor, and Magneto, yeah, his best friend, is a concentration camp survivor. So Legion exists very oddly in this kind of next generation of what it means to kind of reclaim legacy while he's, you know, never quite accepted by his father. There's a lot going on. Are you a fan of Cy Spurrier's Legion series? I think it's delicious.
I think it's fantastic. And I really enjoyed what he did with like Legion of X during the Krakoa era. What I love about the X-Men in general, you and I have been X-Men fans since the dawn of time. It feels like I promise I'm not aging us.
I'm 47. It's fine.
but you don't look a day over 46. but what I love about like X-Men eras is like there's always that little bit of that weirdo book, you know, during the Claremont run in the 80s, New Mutants filled that role and Excalibur did a little bit. In the 90s, you had Generation X, especially when Chris Bachalo was drawing the book. In the 2000s, you had Peter Milligan and Mike Allred's X-Force. In the 2010s, it definitely felt that way with X-Men Legacy. It's like it sits within main continuity. You see like the Jean Grey school in there. You see like Wolverine and Storm and the other X-Men. It does refer to like other events that are happening, but it's such a quirky little book. And I think Cy Spurrier, he's like writing like a DC Vertigo book within the context of Marvel, and I fucking love it. David Haller is a hard character to get right, and I think Cy Spurrier is probably the best writer to tackle him. And you even made a reference that, you know, this title served as a template for Noah Hawley's Legion series on FX. And so like that could not have existed if not for Cy Spurrier. What I liked about the storyline is, you know, making Red Skull the villain. I always think it's really interesting about making Nazis like the antagonists of the X-Men. Like we see with Fenris, you know, we've seen it with others. Clearly like the, you know, the Fellowship of Humans and like, you know, some of the other like sort of anti-mutant groups definitely take a page from like Nazi ideology as well of like sort of like Nazi propaganda and Nazi, you know, imagery. But what's interesting about it is, like, if you think about, like, if you want to take it to its like sort of logical, you know, conclusion, mutants are the next evolution of humans, right? They're the next evolution of mankind, Homo superior, just to mention my podcast. And so if you think about Nazi ideology, they're always talking about the Ubermen, you know, like the next evolution, like they're looking for like what is the ultimate ideal. Wouldn't you think that like mutants would then be part of like kind of Nazi ideology? It's not the blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, Aryan stereotype or the Aryan prototype rather, but it is about like, you know, what where mankind would go. So I think it's very funny that like Nazis are also like can be anti-mutant as well. And there's no discerning of any real logic with their ideology. Yeah, I think it's very, very funny that like they're like, no, wait, you're technically better than us because you have powers, but we also don't like you because you're different than us.
Yeah, I think the trick is, and I've done a lot of research into history and a lot of these Red Skull conversations at this point, the Nazis are only proud of the things that they accomplished themselves. If it's an accomplishment from another community, they're going to strip the resources away and repurpose it for their mission, but they're not going to value anything that is made by someone else. You might be blonde and blue-eyed, but if your grandfather was a Jew, they're not going to value you in the government at all, even if you fit their ideal. So the Red Skull, making these speeches about mongrels and mutants and concentration camps is really fascinating because Legion is wrestling with the concept of what it means to be his father's son, but also his mother's son, which is a subtler theme that I think Cy Spurrier is using here. So his unmet need to like have Xavier acknowledge him now that Xavier's dead, he literally creates in his subconscious a version of his father who's constantly telling him you're a disappointment and driving him to give up what makes him special, which is being a mutant in this storyline, while facing the threat that his mother survived, which is the Red Skull, who's still alive and well. It's very smart. And then this weird mutant who can like take propaganda and like take credit for other people, like, oh, it's my credit now, and no, I've lost everything. I compared that to like an escapade style power. Right. It's a wild flip at the end.
I love mutants that are I call it like sort of like the Doug Ramsey effect too, where like the mutant powers don't manifest like Cyclops or Storm or Wolverine, where like it's not like very overt, but it's this like very weird subtle way of like manipulating things to your advantage. I think that's a really cool idea.
I like a mutant that makes my head hurt just a little bit sometimes. Yeah. We're trying to figure out the powers, and I would love to see a whole team of like Escapade and Santi Sardina and these other characters kind of interacting together. I opened our conversation with the idea of the Smith Act and, you know, what it was created for, how it gets used. We're living in a time of kind of restricted speech and like what patriotism means. And it's jarring to look at this kind of view into history. But what were your thoughts on that opening? And it's kind of parallel to the story.
I mean, it kind of reminds, you know, I just was having this conversation with some friends earlier. You know, there's like the sort of like romanticizing of the FDR era, you know, especially by folks on the left, like folks of my political persuasion. And yes, absolutely. Like, you know, creating the New Deal, creating a lot of things that have been lasting, like Social Security, for example, helping the country get out of depression. You know, we were the quote unquote good guys during World War II against the Axis powers. And of course, when you're fighting Nazis, you're going to be the good guy. But there was a lot of like bad stuff happening in the United States at the same time. Like, I mean, the Smith Act, I mean, when you were describing it, I was just thinking, how is that constitutional? Like, how is it like, it seems like it's a complete violation of the First Amendment of, you know, being able to, you know, like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, so on and so forth. You know, the whole point of the First Amendment is it's not about speech you agree with, but it's about speech that you disagree with too. And, you know, you may have anti-American rhetoric, any anti-American views, but as an American, you should have the right to be able to, and even if you are not, you know, born in the United States, even if you're not a full citizen, you should have still have the right to be able to like espouse your views as long as you're not getting violent. And then you brought up like Japanese internment during this era as well, you know, like a really shameful part of our history. And it does reflect on what's happening today in our society, where you have subversion of speech, you have manipulation of media, and so on and so forth. And it's a really, really scary time. And I think the best fiction, best science fiction, horror, genre fiction, you name it, is when it starts reflecting, what is happening and what has happened in the world's history. The X-Men has always really been great about that, like by reflecting like the prejudices that a minority or a multicultural group faces and how that manifests through storylines.
Yeah, I'm a sociologist, so I've said this a couple times on the show. I give speeches speeches about this kind of thing. But when I look at the far left versus the far right as it exists now and in American history, it's interesting because the far right is dealing with what I would call entrenchment. It's these deeply seated belief systems that have never really been challenged. It's kind of the concept of like wrestling with privilege, and I don't want to have to give anything up. So anything that makes me challenge that thinking is an enemy, right? And this is like, I grew up in the Mormon religion where everyone was an enemy, even though, you know,
right.
you gotta try to make them like you. Where the far left, the thing that unifies people is a diverse group of people who have been accustomed to being a minority group. So we've had this history of things being taken away. So even now, I don't think I've ever heard a single person on the far left say something like, ooh, the far right doesn't deserve the right to vote. They don't deserve the right to assemble. They don't deserve the right to have religion or to talk about. What we're saying is like, why aren't you more decent? Because they're restricting our right to vote. They're restricting our right to exist or have rights. So that brings me to my final question for you, my friend, and you can weave in whatever thoughts here. How you doing in 2026? These are rough times for us queer friends.
All things considered, I'm doing okay. Like on a personal level, I'm doing okay. On a global level, I am scared to shit. You know, like we've been in this administration now for over a year. It's, you know, there's been a lot of bad stuff that's happened. There's like a little bit of a, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, I hope. But also, you know, as we're recording this, you know, the United States and Israel decided to attack Iran. And now
We're recording this on March 1st, everyone. So who knows what's gone on since then?
Yeah, could be the beginning of World War III. It could be a blip. Who the hell knows? But I'm doing okay. But I kind of want to go back to your point about the far left and the far right. You know, the difference between the two, and I think there's a lot of similarities in some ways, but the difference between the two is the far left questions everything, including questioning power, and there's almost like this like aversion to gaining power, and the far right questions nothing. It's like intellectual curiosity almost to a fault, to like zero curiosity.
Yeah.
It's like the far right is like we find like the charismatic leader and we follow orders and we fall in line and boom boom boom. And that's why sometimes it's so much easier to like when you're running, you know, as a conservative, or especially a far right conservative, like it's just so much easier to be message disciplined and be able to like use all the various communication tools and propaganda tools to get what you want. Whereas on the left, like I was just having this conversation with some of my friends, including my fellow podcaster, Brent Wingate, about how the left sometimes can never coalesce. It's always like, let's question the power. Let's question the authority. What have they done wrong? Can they do better? And in a healthy democracy, you want that. But at the end of the day, when you have one side that's very organized, one side that's very disorganized, it's incredibly daunting.
Well, and our country formed as a compromise over slavery. Like half didn't agree and half did. Right. So let's just find a way to get along, which isn't a great template for anything. But I think, in Mormonism, there are literal tenets where they're like, doubt your doubts. If you have anything going on that causes you to question your religion, then you push it away. You know that that's not the right thought pattern.
Yeah.
So just like dig in. Like, I think that's so embedded into the American consciousness in so many ways. And it's a crazy time. I love talking nerdy shit with you. I love talking serious shit with you too. It's always excellent to hang out. And we've got plans for a character episode. We're going to do Black Box together soon, which
I'm excited about. Can't wait.
That'll be a lot of fun. Thanks for joining me today, Kaylin. It's great to see your face. I know you and I are both going through big changes in our lives, and it's an honor to just connect with you for a few minutes. Thanks for your time.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Take care of yourselves. Living joyfully remains an act of defiance in this crazy world. So find your safety. We'll see you all back here next week on The Gray Malkin Lane Show.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.